we're ready to go, and so we'll be the same format we used last week. If anyone has a question, I'll just jump right in, and we'll do it. Okay.
There was something I just wanted to say about last week, if I can. I don't know if you want to put this on the tape or not, but I felt that the people should understand it. I'm on now? Okay. A lot of the Torah has to do with the design of Providence in establishing the nation of Israel. Now, in order that there should be a nation that should be capable of receiving the law and holding it throughout the generations for the entire world. So this, so the Ben Noach might say, well, what do I care about that? It doesn't have to do with me. It has to do with Jewish people. But the idea, it's not an egocentric idea. In other words, it's not an idea that's supposed to make a person feel good that he's Jewish or not. It's the study of God's design is for the sake of understanding how God approaches, the man and how he creates the situation that's best for man. So it really doesn't have to do with the fact that it happens to be the Jewish people. They're the vehicle. But we should all be interested in the ideas and the design of Providence in terms of establishing the nation and making sure that the true ideas, the true philosophy is carried on from generation to generation and made available to all people. Okay. Now, let's go a little further into this area. And we read over here about the, I believe I mentioned 25, from 25 is till, here we have 28, okay, till 28 basically. Now, including a little bit of 28. Now, in the beginning we read that, that Isaac and Rebecca, that they prayed for a child. She was childless, and then Rebecca became pregnant, and she had two children. And the Torah describes at the outset that Esau was a different kind of personality. Even at birth, he appeared different. And then it states that the two grew up. That's in 23:27. And the Torah says that the lad grew up, and Esau was a man who was a very very canny hunter, and he was a man of the field. And Jacob was a simple meaning a plain man who stayed in the tent. In the tent, of course, it means that he was the tent always implied learning. He was a man of study. He was a person who was devoted to knowledge. And Esau, on the other hand, was an outdoorsman. And we know that the Esau was considered a wicked person as we progress in the Torah. But the next verse is interesting, because the next verse says that Isaac loved Esau, and it says, I'm using the translation, the Jerusalem translation, but we'll soon see translations over here fail. They just can't give the proper interpretation. It says, and Yitzchak loved Esau, for he relished his venison. But Rivka, Rebecca, loved Yaakov. Okay. Now, here, the Torah seems to imply, as it does further on as well, that Isaac favored his evil son, who was Esau. And this seems very strange to us. How could Isaac, who is supposedly such a great person, one of the patriarchs, second patriarch, how could he favor the wicked son? And then we read the well-known story later in chapter 27 that when Isaac said he wants to give the blessings, so he wanted to give the blessings to Esau. And instead, we know that Rivka, the mother, their mother, Rebecca, she worked it out that the blessings were given instead to Jacob, and Jacob actually deceived his father, and he put on he covered his arms with the skins to make himself appear like Esau, and the blessings instead were given to Jacob. There's several questions that we want to pose here. One question is, first of all, why couldn't Isaac see through Esau? And the Torah says the reason why he loved him, that verse I mentioned before, was because of the venison. But the literal translation, I'm referring to verse 23-28. The literal translation says the reason why Isaac loved Esau was kitzayid befez. Literally, that means because the prey was in his mouth. And the rabbis comment on that statement, and they say the reason why the Torah expresses it in that unique fashion is because they're trying to tell you something a little bit deeper than the surface meaning. It doesn't just mean because he was a man of the field and he brought back the prey, brought back good food. That wasn't enough to move the great Isaac. But it really means that he tricked them with his mouth. Sayid means to capture someone. So there's a double entendre there. And the rabbis mention, the oral law mentions, that double entendre is there intentionally. Because it wants to convey another meaning beneath the text. And that is that Esau was a man who was able to deceive his father into thinking that he is righteous. The rabbis tell us that whenever he came to his father, he would ask him various questions about halacha and what the man, and philosophy and what the proper way of life is. He would always try to impress his father with his own righteousness. And Isaac, it seems, fell for it. Now, so one question we want to ask is how he was able to deceive his father. That's the first question. Then the second question we'd like to ask is that if we take a look at the blessings that were given on 27:28, it says, God will give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be those that curse thee, and blessed be those that bless thee. That's the extent of the blessing. Now, if we look at the blessing prima facie on the surface, the blessing seems to be one of material wealth, because that's what these things represent. The fat of the land means material wealth. So these are metaphors for material wealth. And the question that we have to ask is, Rove Dagon, you know, much plenty of corn and wine. It means basically all material things. The question is that, is that appropriate for the great Isaac, great patriarch, to have? He has a blessing for his children, so is that the best blessing he can give them, just to give them material wealth? Is that the great blessing? And this is a question that strikes us as strange for such a great person. Then when we continue on in the chapter, we find that after Jacob was able to fool his father, and he told, you know the story, I assume that you've gone through the basic story, where he called Esau and he told him to go bring him a delicious meal. And then, as Esau went out, Rebekah prepared the meal, sent in Jacob, and he thought it was Esau, and gave these blessings to Jacob instead of thinking that it was in fact Esau. Then afterwards, after Jacob left, in came Esau from the hunt, and he went to his father, awaiting sin to give him the blessings. But Isaac was astonished because he couldn't understand it. As a matter of fact, he was extremely frightened. And here we have an expression of the Torah that's very unusual, but it says, and that's in verse 33, 27:33. It says, and Yitzchak trembled very much. It says, Charada Gadola means an extreme fright. Ad Ma'od, in Hebrew you have an extra word here, which means a great fright, and Ad Ma'od means very, extremely great. And he said, who is this that brought the food before? And I blessed him. And he says, and he adds the words, he says, and it is true, he shall be blessed. Then it says, when Esau heard this, he cried, he broke out with a bitter cry. And he said, can't bless me also, my father. And then his father said, your brother came through trickery and took away your blessing. So then Esau complained about the fact that that Jacob had tricked him before, taking away the birthright, and now he tricked him again. And then he begs his father. father. He says, isn't there any blessing you have left? So Isaac says to Esau, at verse 37, he says to Esau, look, he says, I made him your lord, and all his brethren I gave, I made them servants, and I gave them the plenty of corn and then the wine. And he says, what else can I do? What can I do, my son? There's nothing left. So Esau said, isn't there one blessing that you have for me? He says, bless me also, my father. And he raised his voice and he cried. So then Isaac said to him, he says, it sounds like he thought of another blessing. And he says, behold, thy dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven. That's verse 39. And the dew of heaven above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and thou shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke off thy neck. Okay? Now, the question again over here is, what transpired in this little dialogue? At first it seems Isaac said there's nothing left, which would seem to make sense, because he gave away all the material good, and basically Esau was interested in the material good. So then it sounds like somehow or other Isaac was able to conjure up another blessing. And when he finally does, after Esau pleads with him a few times, it sounds like he gives the exact same blessing that he just gave to Jacob. So this seems strange, because he also mentions the fat of the earth and the dew of the ground. I'm sorry, the dew of heaven. And what is disturbing is that it would seem there's a duplication. And why is it at first that he couldn't think of anything, and then suddenly came up with this, which is basically duplication? So we have really three basic questions. First question is, how is it that Esau was able to fool Isaac? That's one. Second question is, what kind of a blessing did he have in mind for his children? It seems it's all materialism. And the third question is, how did he come up with the last moment, sort of, just to appease Esau? He seems to have come up with some concept, some idea. But when you take a look at it, it seems like the exact same thing as very similar to the type of thing that he already blessed Jacob with. Okay. Now, the rabbis give us an opening here into understanding this whole chapter. And that is, the rabbis say, there is an oral law commentary, that on every one of these things, they apply a strange type of addition. Like, for instance, they say, the dew of the heavens, this means the Torah. And then they add Mishmanei Ha'aretz, the fat of the land. This means this refers to the oral law. And they break it down. Rov Dagon, on each one they break down to another component of Torah, basically. And the question is, why does the oral law go out of its way to take the passage out of its literal meaning? And this in general is a problem, and I imagine especially B'nai Noach, but not just B'nai Noach. I think B'nai Yisrael have the same problem. That when they look at some of these Medrashim, they sound strange and wild, and sometimes people are even enthused about them because they're so strange. They appeal sometimes to people's imagination. And that really is not good, because if the Medrash is strange, it doesn't really open up the ideas of the Torah, then that means that you don't understand the Medrash. Medrash is supposed to do one thing. When you uncover and you unravel a Medrash, it's supposed to make the Torah's meaning plain and clear. Now, we want to understand this. We're going to take this Medrash and try to analyze. Why does the Medrash... What the Medrash is doing, really, is the Medrash is making a switch. It's taking all these things that seem like materialism and it's changing them. It's saying, no, when it says the dew of the heavens, this means so. When it says the fat of the land, this means the... I don't know exactly how they break it down, but the idea is the same. And this means Talmud, and this means Mishnah, and it means... all these things are references to components of Torah. Now, why does the Medrash do this? And I think the reason, well, if we understand this Medrash, we'll be able to understand the whole story and what actually transpires a little bit beneath the scenes, so to speak, so we can really get a glimpse of what actually took place. Because the Torah is written on several levels. It just wants to give you the basic story for any most simple person should have some idea. But it's also written in a way, God wrote the Torah in a double manner. So it could be something that a simple person can gain knowledge from, and also a great scholar can uncover deeper ideas and deeper meaning and gain more insight into what's going on. So the Medrash really is the key to the oral is the key to uncovering the deeper meaning. And you see, what happened was like this, that what he meant when he gave those blessings and why the Medrash ties it to the Torah, different components of the Torah, the written law, the oral law, the Mishnah, you know, the reason is because the Medrash is explaining what Isaac really had in mind. What Isaac had in mind was to give, it was material, what he was talking about, because you cannot remove the plain meaning of the Torah. But the objective was really Torah. In other words, his blessing was to give the blessing of the material world, but it was not for the purpose of the material world, because Isaac was a great patriarch, and he knew that the ultimate existence of man is not the material, but it really is the knowledge of Torah, the world of God's wisdom and closeness to God. So he really gave the material world, but the objective is stated by the Medrash. The material world was for the objective of Torah, for the objective of the Mishnah, for the objective of the Talmud, for the objective of all the metaphysical aspects of life. That was really his purpose. But he knew very well that a person cannot engage in the material, cannot engage in the spiritual unless he has the material. And this is really against, I guess, the famous statement of Christianity, David and I were just discussing last week, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, render unto God that which is God's. This is in direct opposition to that concept. Because what the Torah is telling us is that Isaac realized that you cannot give Caesar what the Caesar wants, because once Caesar has the control of the material, then you can't do the spiritual either, because man has to have a material existence. That's his nature. And if you don't have control over the material, you can't have the spiritual either. Man cannot live without the material is there as a means for the spiritual. So Isaac knew this very well. And Isaac's intention was really to give the material for the purpose of the spiritual. Now, see, Isaac was a person who the Talmud describes as it's called in Hebrew an ola tamima, which means a pure sacrifice, which means to say he was a type of individual that really, if you notice in the Torah, he never had much to do with the outside world. Abraham was the one that went out into the world, and he was he mingled with kings, and he was a person that was able to teach people. He was the father of masses of people, great following. Whereas Isaac, while he continued in the philosophy of his father, as we mentioned last week, but if you read the Bible and you're sensitive to the text, you sense immediately it's not in the same type of proportion. And the reason is that we don't believe this was a defect in Isaac. But we believe that there are different types of personalities, and that's one of the premises of Torah. That every individual has a unique personality, and every individual has to serve God in accordance with his own nature. You can't copy somebody else. Albeit the person is a great person, it may be very great. But the fact is that each individual has his own potential and his own type of personality. You have to live according to your own way, your own emotions, and your own psyche, your own predisposition, as they say. Now, Isaac was not an individual that was able to see through a lot of the trickery in the world. He was a person that was sheltered, and he was an individual that was a person that only really was at home in the world of ideas. There are people, you see, Jacob, on the other hand, was not that way. Jacob was a person that knew, as a matter of fact, the rabbi said that he was the master of trickery. That Jacob knew how to employ trickery when it was the just thing to do. And that is proper, too. That if a person is trying to be deceitful to you, So the halacha says, so don't be fooled by him. But on the contrary, you should outdo him and do and if justice is on your side, then you should do the thing which is just, even if it's for yourself. But not everyone has the ability to see through this type of thing. Isaac was raised in the house of Abraham, and he was a very straight person. And that's why you'll notice, for instance, he didn't even go to get a wife for himself. And Abraham sent Eliezer, if you remember, to get a wife for him. He was not a man of the world. Not everybody's a man of the world. There are two different types of righteous people. There are righteous people that are men of the world, and then there are righteous people who sort of are reclusive. And there's nothing wrong with that. Not everybody is a person that can live in both worlds. Some people are more prone to live a Torah life within a circle. Within, in other words, be in a situation where they're sheltered from the outside world. They're not capable, really. They don't have those abilities to go into the outside world as other people do. Abraham was a man of the world. Isaac was a righteous man, different kind of righteous man. Now, Isaac really was a person, being a person that didn't understand too well, because of his own righteousness, he didn't understand too well what trickery was. He wasn't able to spot it too quickly. You know, Plato says an interesting thing, and I think the Torah would agree with it. And that is, most people, the reason why you have the way that they can tell that another person is doing something crooked is they look into their own hearts, and they see what they would do, and then they see, and then they recognize it in somebody else. So many times, the reason why people figure out scams or some other kind of or other type of trickery is because they themselves are think along those lines. And sometimes a righteous person, truly righteous person, isn't that skilled. He's not that type of person himself, and therefore he doesn't recognize it in others. If he's intelligent, he can learn it. It could be something that could be taught. But on the surface, he won't spot it. And if he doesn't go out in the world too much, he's very naive. I know that Albert Einstein was that type of a person also, that they used to, people would come to him with all kinds of, to endorse all kinds of things, and they'd fool him, and he'd endorse these things. He just didn't expect anybody to be dishonest. And he wasn't a cunning man. He was a very, very simple person. On the other hand, we have righteous people that are very cunning, because they're very sharp, and not because they're tricky, not because they themselves are deceitful, but because they observe the world, and then they learn through knowledge and through experience, they learn what deceit is, and then they become, of course, because they're very intelligent, they can even be sharper at recognizing deceit than a deceitful person. But that was Jacob's personality, but that was not Isaac. Rebekah, on the other hand, she came from the house of Laban. And Laban, as you remember, was a master of deceit. And that's what we read in last week's Sedra. How Laban was able to fool Jacob. First, he gave him Leah instead of Rachel, and he switched his compensation many times, 100 times, the Talmud says. And he was a master businessman. Everything he did was exactly what the businessman would do. For instance, when Jacob came to work for him, so first he says, he spoke very nice. He says, you're not my brother, work for me for nothing. He says, tell me what your wages are. You notice a good businessman never tells you what he wants to give you. He doesn't say he's afraid maybe he's offering too much. He says, tell me what you want. And if it's lower than he had in mind, so he's happy. If it's higher, then he'll start bargaining with you. And every step, if you look through the Torah, it's an interesting thing, we'll go there another time. Every step that Laban did was like for a master skilled businessman. I don't mean businessman in a good sense. There are good businessmen. I'm just using the term in a sense of being a person that is able to amass a lot of money by using other people. And that was Laban. Now Rebecca came from the house of Laban, so she was able to recognize the deceit. And in her two children, she was able to recognize the deceitfulness of Esau. Now, Isaac, on the other hand, being a simple person, a straight person, he didn't see this in Esau. And he not only didn't see this, but he didn't want to see it. And he really could not believe that anything evil could be related to him. He had no relationship to such things. And he therefore, he noticed, of course, that that Jacob is a person who is the man that's in the tent. He's the person who is really the student. He's the philosopher, the thinker, the man of God. And he knew the difference between the two. As a matter of fact, you see in the Torah, you take a look just to show you how that Isaac did know this difference. He wasn't totally taken in by Esau. If you take a look, it says as follows. When Jacob brought the food, that's in 27:20, okay? So, of course, he came right away. He wanted to come before Esau would return. So he brought the food to his father, and it says that Isaac asked him, he said, how come you came back so quickly? How did you manage to get this food so fast? So then Jacob answered, he says, because God your God appeared before me. Then it says, in 21, it says, Isaac says, draw near and let me touch him, my son. I want to see if this is really my son Esau. Why? Because the oral law explains that why do you suspect Jacob at that point? Because Jacob said that God appeared before me. And he said to himself, Esau isn't the type of person that talks about God. That's not his style. He doesn't just think in terms of God in everything he does. And when he heard this, he immediately said, one second, come closer. Let me see if this is really my son Esau. And then it says he didn't recognize him. He didn't recognize him because of the fact that his hands were covered. And he thought that it was really Esau. But you see that from the oral law, you see that Isaac did really know that there was a difference between his two sons, even though he didn't recognize fully what Esau was. Now, what he saw, what Isaac saw, Isaac's vision, Isaac's understanding of his two children were as follows. He felt that Jacob is really the man of the, he's the man of study. He's the man that sits in a tent, he's the man of study, the man of ideas, and he is the one that really is the true scholar, the true righteous person. Esau, on the other hand, is a man of the field. But he didn't think that that is bad, because again, the philosophy of Torah is that every person has to be perfected within his own nature and within his own abilities. He saw Esau as being an individual that has a lot of emotion and passion for life, and he thought that he is not the scholarly type. You can't expect this boy to become a great scholar and a great sage. It's just not within his makeup. And therefore, he felt, fine, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But he felt that Esau was still, underneath it all, Esau was a good person. As I said, Esau would come to his father with different questions to show that he has an interest in philosophy and Torah. And his father believed that. He just thought his nature doesn't lend itself to be a student. Jacob, on the other hand, is the true scholar. He is the true student. He is the one who is really going to take over the world of ideas. But he felt in his mind that this would be a remarkable combination. Here you have the successful man, Esau, who's the man, the outgoing man, the man of the field. And on the other hand, you have this righteous, withdrawn individual who's in the world of spirits. So he felt that this is an ideal combination. And what should be done is as follows, that the blessings of the material wealth should really be given to Esau. And the blessings of the spiritual world should be given to Jacob. And you'll see this is true. If you take a look a little further, in chapter 28, right in the beginning, it says, 28:3-4, okay? In 28 it says that Isaac called Jacob, and he blessed him, and he charged him, and said to him, you shouldn't take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. He said, go to Padan Aram, to the house of the Tuel, and then he says, in 3, and God Almighty should bless you, and make you fruitful, and multiply, and then you may become a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of it. Now, if you take a look, you'll see again in 28:3, so Isaac does. In 28, Isaac calls in Jacob, and he gives him these blessings, and he says to him that you should have the blessing of Abraham to you and to your seed with you. So you should inherit the land which God gave to Abraham. That's in verse 3 and 4. So here, you see that he had another blessing. Because if he only had one blessing to give, then he had already given that to Jacob, and there would be no reason to call him in and bless him again. But the answer is, when you read between the lines in the Torah, you see the answer is that actually Isaac had two blessings to give over. One blessing was the material wealth, the other blessing was the blessing of Abraham, which means the wealth of the world of ideas, the metaphysical wealth. And he had both of these blessings to give over. And his plan was not a foolish plan. His plan was, here we have Esau, the outgoing, successful man, the man of the world, the man that can go out and accomplish in the outside world. And he's not a scholar. On the other hand, my other son is just the opposite. He's always in the tent. He's always studying. He's the man of ideas, the man of metaphysics. He's the man that's always talking about God. So he said, this is a wonderful combination. What I have to do is, God's will must be that I should give the blessing of the material to my outgoing son, and the blessing of the spiritual should be given to to my son Jacob. And this would be a beautiful union, a great partnership, that Esau will be the man that's going to be the one that will make sure the physical needs are all taken care of, the physical security will be there, and the scholar will be free to pursue his knowledge and his work. He shouldn't be bothered with the business world and with being a successful businessman. That's not his area. And in his mind, he was very satisfied with his solution to his dilemma of these two blessings and how to give them over. Because he felt very happy. He felt that both sons of his were really good, and he couldn't relate to anything evil, as I said before. Now, what happened was that these blessings were given over with a divine inspiration. So that when I said given over with divine inspiration, that means that when he gave that blessing, he was in a state of divine inspiration. And he knew, once he gave that blessing, that's it. Because, you see, when Esau walked in and he said that my brother stole my blessings, what he meant was, why couldn't he just give them and say, look, I canceled the original ones and give out new ones? The answer is, he knew through prophecy that these blessings would be given in a prophetic state. And since he saw that this prophetic state did exist when he gave the blessing, that's why he said he can't take it back. As a matter of fact, he said, and if you take a look at 27, when Esau came in, 27:33, he says, and Isaac trembled very much and said, who then is he that has taken venison and brought it to me and has eaten of all before you came, and I have blessed him? Moreover, he shall be blessed. Why did he say he shall be blessed? He realized that once he was given in that prophetic state, that was it. It cannot be taken back. And at that moment, he was overcome with an unbelievable fear. What was this fear? The fear and the trembling that took place was because he realized that his whole plan was mistaken. And there was only one possibility left. And that is, since the material was given to Jacob, the material world, and he knew the spiritual world had to be given to Jacob, but Esau could not inherit that. Then he realized an unbelievable tragedy, and that is that Esau must be an evil person. There can't be any hope for Esau. Because he thought, if my plan was correct, then that blessing should not have taken place for Jacob. That was Esau's. But since you see that it was given through divine inspiration, that means it's too late. And Esau must be an evil person. The idea of him being the progenitor of an evil being was so frightening to him that it made him tremble. And that was the great trembling that he had. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say there were two times in Isaac's life that he trembled. One time was when he was at the Akedah, when Abraham was ready to sacrifice him, and the second time was when Esau came in after Jacob left. And the rabbis say, which trembling was greater? So the oral law says this was greater, because it says Harada Gedola Ad Me'od, a great, extremely great trembling. And the reason why he trembled more over here was when his father wanted to sacrifice him, when Abraham wanted to sacrifice him, that was a fear of losing his life. But this was even a greater fear, that he should be the progenitor of a son that is actually evil. This, to him, was something he just simply could not tolerate. Then Esau begged him, and Esau said to him that, he said, please, he said, isn't there any blessing left? So first he said, no, there is no blessing left, because there's only the spiritual and there's only the material. The material I gave him already, the spiritual, I'm definitely going to give to Jacob. So there is nothing left. But then when he kept on pleading with him, what he did was an interesting thing. He gave a similar blessing, but if you look very closely, the blessing is conditional, because he said as follows. He says that, he said to him that, your dwelling will be from the fat of the earth and from the dew of the heavens, and you'll live on your sword, by your sword, and you'll serve your brother. But then he says, in Hebrew, it's v'hoya kasher torit. And what this means is, if you take a look at Rashi, what it means is, when Jacob's people, meaning the Israelites, when they violate the Torah, then you will have the physical. In other words, it was given to him as follows. He said, he thought to himself that there is one blessing left. I've given away the spiritual. I will give away the spiritual. I have given away the material. But there's one thing. I gave away the material for the sake of the spiritual. But there's one more blessing left, and that is the material for the sake of the material. And that he gave to Esau, because he realized that Esau, that is what Esau is. He can't go beyond the material. And he said, that's why he said that as long as Jacob and his offspring keep the Torah, then they'll have the material as a means for the spiritual. But if they neglect the Torah, if they go into the physical for its own sake, then you, Esau, will have it. So he gave that last blessing, and that was what he worked out in the last moment. Once he came to the realization that Esau is not a good person, Esau is a person who is just the physical, just the material. Maybe he didn't think he was really evil, but he thought it was a man that can't do anything more than just live a biological existence just for the sake of the material, which is really very far from the ideal that Isaac thought that Esau really was. And that's why he said, there's one thing left. The material world for the sake of the material world, just for the physical enjoyment. That I'm taking away. That's my restriction. That Jacob has the blessings of the material for the purpose of the spiritual, but the material just for the sake of material physical enjoyment, that Esau is yours. So the moment that Jacob and his offspring leave the Torah, and they leave the way of the Torah, the material is taken away from them. That was Isaac's ingenuity at the last moment that he came up with that last blessing. Now Esau, of course, was a person that you have to realize, when you think about the personality of Esau, again, just to make it clear that even though Isaac was a very righteous individual and didn't understand the seed, he wasn't a man of the world, but he was still not a fool. You have to realize that. And his plan and his idea was not totally crazy. There was some basis for what he said. And if you look closely, you'll see. There's an interesting statement, again, from the Orloff in the Talmud. The Talmud tells a story that one of the rabbis was very sick. And the other rabbis came to visit him. And one of them, well, they were speaking about how great he is, and they said that he fulfills the commandment of honoring his mother greater than anybody else. So one of the rabbis said, he didn't even reach half of what Esau was in terms of honoring his father. So this sounds like a very strange statement, that Esau, the wicked man, honored his father greater than the biggest sage, the greatest scholar. Doesn't make any sense. But the answer is a very deep one. Esau really did honor his father. See, Esau was a personality that to him, his father was everything. But it was on an emotional level. It wasn't that he was so interested in Isaac's ideas. Really, it was interesting. He was just a man of the physical world. But emotionally, he was very tied to his father. And you see, for instance, how the Torah tells us that Rebekah took the clothes, the beautiful clothes of her son that were in the house, and she gave them to Jacob before he went in to act the part of Esau. So you see, he had these special expensive clothes that he kept in his house that he put on before he went to see his father. And he wanted to appear in front of his father, that his father should only think the highest of him. And the greatest thing in Esau's life was that his father should love him and should approve of him and should feel great pride in his son. That was an emotional, very strong emotional attachment that he had to his father. That's why he cared so much about the blessings. It wasn't so much that he was interested in the blessings themselves, although, of course, that was something that he did want, the physical world. But more important than that even was to have his father's approval. And his whole life was geared toward that. That's why when the Talmud says that he would be a person that captivated his father by his mouth, that wasn't just to fool him, it was because he needed that input. He really had tremendous respect for his father. What the Talmud is saying is that Esau, under such an emotional force, was far greater to his father than even the greatest rabbi could be, because that was his whole life. But the Talmud doesn't mean to say that is really the highest level of existence, because Esau's reason was simply an emotional one. It wasn't really the true idea of respect for a father and a mother. The true concept of respect for father and mother, as I may have mentioned before, is because father and mother and the Torah's idea of respecting father and mother is really, as far as the biological father and mother is concerned, is because they reflect God, because they are the cause of your existence. And that brings to mind the ultimate cause of your existence, which is God. That is the true philosophical idea of honoring father and mother. That's why if father and mother tell you to violate the Torah, you're not allowed to listen to them, because their respect is really based on the fact that they reflect the idea of the ultimate creator. But if they go against the ultimate creator, then, of course, one is not permitted to listen to them. Esau was attached on a purely emotional level to his father. It wasn't the deep idea of honoring the father and mother that the Torah has in mind. It was purely a very strong emotional attachment. And what the Talmud is saying is that under the force of this emotion, no one could beat him in terms of practice of honoring father or mother, even the greatest scholar. Because a great scholar could be wonderful to his parents, but it still can't compare with somebody like Esau, who's driven by this powerful emotional force. Again, you see the insight of the Torah into people's personalities. And while Esau may have acted in a way that he surpassed honoring his father and his mother, it still doesn't mean that he was in any way on a higher level than the great scholar who didn't do so well in that area, because the great scholar was doing it for the right reason, and he had the right quality of honoring his father and mother, and that really is what is important. But the Talmud is just speaking in terms of practice and giving us some psychological insight into Esau's nature. So Esau really was a person who wasn't, as we think, you know, when we think about an evil person, we just think about somebody that's mean and vicious, and that's not true. That's a very bad and very infantile kind of image to have in your mind, because the people are more complex than that, and even people who are so-called evil still have certain aspects of their nature that really people would identify with. And it's important that we should have a little bit of a deeper understanding of what is meant by evil. By evil is meant, really, a person that is guided essentially by the instinctual. A person is guided by the instinctual, that really is evil. The good is to be guided by the tselem elokim, the divine element of man, which is man's pure mind, his wisdom, his knowledge of Torah. And that is the difference between the good person and the evil person. We see that Esau, as bad as he was, he could be overcome by emotion and can act in a good way too. Later we find when Jacob confronted him, when he confronted Jacob, so he felt sorry for him. When Jacob pleaded and begged him, that's in Genesis 33, when they met, and Jacob was afraid that Esau was going to destroy him, and Esau, on the contrary, he pleaded and he begged, and Esau felt sorry for him, and he kissed him, and he took him around. You see, Esau was a man that was capable of brotherly love. As a matter of fact, he said, come, go with me, we'll go together, we'll work together. And Jacob, of course, went his way. He didn't go with him. But you see, Esau wasn't a person that was just evil the way we think. I mean, he was capable of varying emotion. Sometimes he could be very kind, and sometimes he could act nicely, but underneath it all, there was that the instinctual drive really controlled his life, and that's why the Torah considers him to be in the category of evil. But yes, in terms of Isaac, as a father, when a father who doesn't want to really is not really involved in the world and doesn't really scrutinize that well to see whether there's evil behind the deceitful. So a person like that, who has a son that he loves, and the son's entire life is just to gain the approval of the father, you can see how easily it would be for even an intelligent person to be fooled. And especially the way he understood the blessings and how they should be given over. To him, it was a great plan. And that basically is what the Medrash is teaching us when it gives us a few words, a little insight into the blessings, and it states the blessings all stand for metaphysical, gives you the metaphysical, that the dew is really the Torah, and the fat of the land is the Talmud, and the other one is the Midrash, and the other one is the various components of Torah. But it's trying to, that little bit of insight that the Midrash gives us really opens up the entire story of Jacob and Esau, and it shows you the way, it gives you the entire picture with regard to Isaac, how he viewed him, how he viewed both of them. And it really, really shows you, when you look through the Bible itself, you see the consistency to the various texts that we've taken up on this subject. So let me stop at this point, and let me ask if there are any questions that I could handle in this area. Well?
All right, we'll go. Any questions? Everybody's kind of sitting around looking. So, let's proceed. We have about 10 more minutes.
Okay.
All right. You're doing good. Just keep it up. Are you going to go into in chapter 33, are you going to go into the meeting there of Esau and Jacob?
Chapter 33.
Yeah.
There's an interesting point about that meeting.
But, yeah.
Take with the beginning of the meeting, it has to do really with an idea. Let me see if you see the beginning of the chapter with him. And right in the beginning, in chapter 30, number, verse 5. There's an oral tradition on this verse. It says that Yaakov sent his messengers to Esau, that's in verse 4, and then it says, he commanded them, saying, that thus shall you speak to my lord, Esau. It says, thy servant Yaakov says thus, I have sojourned with Lavan, or Laban, and stayed there until now. And the rabbis say the word garti that he uses is really... It numerically, it comes up to 613. And the rabbis say that when what Jacob was saying to Esau was really that I stayed with Laban and I kept the 613 commandments, which means to say basically, doesn't necessarily mean that he had 613 commandments. As you know, there are various opinions about that, whether the patriarchs really kept the commandments, whether they just kept the seven laws of Noah. But it means to say that he kept the system and the way of life and the philosophy of the Torah. And he didn't deviate and didn't stray. And the question that, of course, is raised is, why should he have to say something like that to Esau? Esau's really not too interested in that. I think it really shows you an interesting thing. It shows you that, that many people feel that anti-Semitism is brought about by the Torah itself, and by keeping by the fact that the Jew is different and keeps the Torah. That's some people's philosophy. And I'm not saying that there isn't something to that also, but apparently what Jacob was trying to say was that Esau, he was telling Esau basically that he really is in the world of ideas. This is his world, and he never really went into the other material world. What really would be disturbing to a person like Esau would be that Jacob really conquered both worlds. That would be something that would arouse the hatred. And that's why the oral tradition tells us that in that message he was really trying to tell Esau that basically he keeps the law, he keeps the Torah, and this has been his area for his entire life, and he's not into the material world. When Esau saw that, so Esau really felt compassion for him, as I mentioned before, and it brought out the good side of his emotions. But there again, you see, a person that is emotionally good, this is something which Judaism and other religions really differ on. And that is that in other religions, if a person is emotionally good, even though there is no rational reason for them to be that way, they will consider that person to be a righteous person. Whereas in Torah, we don't say that. We say that without knowledge, there really can't be any righteousness. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says that a person who feels compassion and sympathy and pity for an evil person eventually will be mean and cruel to a person who is actually good. And the reason is that if a person has compassion for an evil individual, it shows you that he does not really care he doesn't really care about the good people. Because if he did care about the good people, he couldn't support the evil person. Supporting the evil person and helping the evil person is really actually being cruel to the good people. And even though if an individual would come, if an individual who is evil would come begging and he'd be in a situation where he needs my assistance, and without my giving him my assistance, he may perish. If he is truly an evil individual, then we should allow him to perish. And you shouldn't try to save him, because by saving him, what you're doing is you're destroying the rest of mankind. And this is really the philosophy of Torah. That's why the Torah has the destruction of the Amalekites, which is a commandment in the Torah. And many people feel that how could Torah do such a thing? How could he destroy people? It's true. We don't want to destroy people.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Amplify a little bit what you mean by a total wicked person.
Okay.
And you hit it just a little bit, but I'd like for you to amplify that, and you got about 5 minutes.
Okay. You mean give an example? A total evil person? I would say a Nazi.
Alright, we need an example of what it means to be
be kind to an evil person.
What it means, how do you know who's really evil when you look at the providence of God?
Okay.
And you measure that by the providence of God. And how do you know that this person is not, God is not using this individual to bring about his purpose?
Okay.
All right, you got it?
Yes, I got it.
Okay.
In other words, and according to the Torah, if a person, let's say he has Nazis, and Nazis are intent on destroying people. Now, you don't say, well, these people are God's messengers coming to destroy me. That is not the philosophy of Torah. Torah says when you see an individual who is evil and who is going to destroy good people, including yourself, you destroy him first. When Moses saw the Egyptian, that he was smiting the Jew, then Moses smote the Egyptian, and he killed him. The philosophy of Torah is an active one. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting, in this, right in this area where it says that Jacob was about to meet Esau, it says he prepared in three ways. He prayed to God, he prepared the present that he was going to give to Esau to appease him, and he also prepared for war, if necessary. So Torah is a realistic system. We pray to God, but God wants us to work within the framework that he has given us. And if we see an evil individual, a person who's bent on doing harm to mankind, we must destroy him. As I one time mentioned, if somebody would be able to know, of course you can't know, if somebody would see Hitler as a baby, it would certainly be a righteous action to destroy him. And I'm just giving you a hypothetical case. No one could know in advance. But I'm just saying that according to Torah, that would be the correct thing to do. That the person who has compassion and sympathy for the evil person is really a destroyer of mankind, because he has no compassion for the righteous people that this individual is going to destroy. So there again, to just be emotionally good is not enough, is not a value in the eyes of the Torah. The Torah demands that a person must seek the good, but it must be with his intelligence and with his mind and with reason. And if reason dictates that you should not be kind to someone, as much as kindness is a wonderful emotion in general, in specific, in certain cases, it is a bad emotion. And a person must be able to control that emotion and to do an action which would be considered an aggressive action. In order...
Rabbi?
Yes.
Point. In that light, what if we know of a person that is doing evil, he's destroying people spiritually by the lies that he teaches?
Then certainly you should do everything that you can to stop that. The person must do everything that he can to stop such thing. There's no question about that. The person is destroying the lives of other individuals by teaching them lies, then they should be exposed and they should be stopped, if it can be done. I mean, if it's possible for you to do it, then you should do it. The Torah is very clear about that. As a matter of fact, you have the case in Deuteronomy where the Torah speaks about a person who may be a member of your family, and if they try to induce others to serve idols or to be involved in idolatry and evil, then you have to give them over to the Beis Din, and they have to kill them. So the Torah, while God does not want to destroy any of his creatures, he does not want an evil individual to destroy the lives of the good people. And we have to be very careful in that area not to allow our emotion of kindness to impede justice. That's what happens many times in this society. There's a tremendous amount of emotion for the criminal. The Torah, by the way, is very much against that. If you just read the Bible, you'll see the Torah is very much in favor of, on the contrary, of making an example of the criminal, that people should know that they have to keep the law. And once the society loses, once you give over the society to evil people, you can forget it. I mean, that's it. It's the end of all the good people. That is not the Torah way. So emotional goodness, emotional kindness is fine as long as it's guided by the supremacy of a person's mind. Once the emotion takes over, then a person can do all kinds of harm, because they could be emotionally kind to the wrong people and then be harmful to the good people. It must be under the supremacy of the person's intellect, of the person's mind. That's really the ideal of Torah, and that differs a lot from other religions where they respect the emotional. They feel that the emotional is the essence. Emotional can be a very dangerous thing. It has to be guided by, bridled by reason.
We've got about 1 minute left, and you just opened a Pandora's box. And we'll have to talk about this more.
Okay, we can continue next week if you like.
Yeah, she said it has to be bridled with reason, what someone just said here, but this is a major, this could be a major thing in relation to what we're doing as B'nai Noach.
Okay.
So that's about the end of this tape, so I think we'll have to stop right here.
Okay, if there are any points in specific that you'd like me to go into, I can continue on the theme next week if you'd like.